Welcome to the PCAM podcast, brought to you by the Society for the Producers and Composers of Applied Music. Welcome everyone to another episode of the PCAM podcast, and today's episode is called There and Then to Here and Now. And this is PCAM, Past, Present and Future. I'm your host today. My name is Banky Ojo. I'm a media composer and sound designer. I work across both long and short form. On the long form side, I write bespoke music for TV and film, both factual and drama. And on the short form side, as well as music composition, I also design soundscapes and deliver creative audio services for advertising and branded content with some of the world's biggest brands. I'm joined today by two colleagues on the PCAM committee. We've got Chris Smith from the Barbershop Music Company and Paul Reynolds from Massive Music. I'll hand over to each of you in turn to introduce yourselves before we get cracking. Chris.
Yeah, well, as Banky says, thank you. I'm Chris Smith. I'm one of the directors of PCAM. I have been in the industry a very long time, about 34 years, in fact, and I'm a composer and producer. I run a little company called the Barbershop Music Company.
Hi, I'm Paul Reynolds. I'm the current chair of PCAM, which is the Society for the Producers and Composers of Applied Music. I'm also Senior Vice President of Creative Services for Massive Music, a song trader company, and have spent the last 20 years working in music for advertising and marketing business.
Excellent. Welcome, gents, and thank you for joining us today. Right. I wanted to start off with a bit of a quote, actually, just to set the context for this episode. If you don't know where you come from, then you don't know where you are. And if you don't know where you are, then you don't know where you're going. And if you don't know where you're going, you're probably going wrong. And that's from Terry Pratchett, I shall Wear Midnight. I thought that might be a nice way to just flavour what it is that we're doing here today, taking a look at and understanding the history of PCAM, its position in the world, what it helps us with, its context, and some of the challenges that we're facing now and its role into the future. So, both long-standing members of PCAM, and actually I've been looking forward to this because this will be an educational road for myself to get some real context on PCAM. But yeah, let's take a trip down memory lane. Let's understand the history of PCAM. What was happening at the time? Why was it necessary then? And how did it all come about?
I'll defer that one to Chris, as I was 8 years old when PCAM was formed.
Yes. Were you saying it was 83?
1982.
It was formed. So I wasn't actually in the industry at that time. We do still have somebody, Tony Satchell, on our committee who was, but I came along a few years after that. But basically, when it was formed, the landscape of media music was very, very different to how it appears today. There were a few London-based music production companies, and when I say a few, maybe six production companies, each with a roster of uniquely represented composers. Some quite large rosters by today's standard of people who were only available through those particular production companies. And they really did everything. And the reason for it, it wasn't called PCAM when it started, it was called SPAM, mm-hmm. which is the Society of Producers of Advertising Music. Mm-hmm. So the name PCAM actually in itself acknowledges some of the way in which the organisation has evolved. But at the time, it was an organisation that was set up by people who were predominantly administrators, people running the production companies. And it was set up in order to establish good working conditions, terms and conditions under which they were employed. As I say, I wasn't there at the time, clearly, there were issues that needed to be resolved. My understanding, and anybody who knows differently will probably write in and tell me I'm wrong, but my belief and my understanding is that actually media composers and these production companies actually withdrew their labour, which is something we can dream about today. But they actually stopped for, I think, up to about 6 months. Wow. Nobody did any work. They refused to work until they got a sit down and thrashing out better terms. And the result of their solidarity has meant that as an organisation, we, PCAM or SPAM as it was, achieved a sort of form of regulation, if you like, which is pretty much unparalleled, actually, in the world of media music. So, you know, they hammered out a standard contract, the structure upon which budgets and licences were issued, and with this, with the IPA, which is the Institute of Practitioners of Advertising, which is the organisation that represents advertising agencies. So it was very much an organisation geared up for advertising music. And as I say, it was really created or driven by administrators rather than by creators. And the fact that we've changed our acronym today from SPAM to PCAM acknowledges the shift in the landscape, so that it's not merely producers, or very often sometimes it's producers who are also creating music themselves. So PCAM is the producers and composers of applied music, again, a spread in contexts, not just advertising, because as you demonstrate yourself, Banky, and, you know, most of us do, a lot of us work in a lot of different forms of media music, and so we've called that applied music, which is music written to be applied to other media mm-hmm. forms. So that is the potted history of the origin of SPAM as was and PCAM as is.
Mm. Paul, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, when I came into the industry, and that's pretty much 20 years ago now, PCAM provided sort of many things, and it was very prevalent within the industry. It was something that you just needed to be a member of to be able to operate in the industry. Mm. What PCAM providers was indispensable. I mean, we had, firstly, the pink form, and it was originally a pink form because SPAM's pink. And I think it was quite funny.
There's for some branding.
The phrase was, I'm pink, therefore I'm SPAM.
Yeah. So the pink form was, and some people still use pink backgrounds for these forms. It was basically the IPA PCAM contract. It's the contract that we have with creative agencies, and it's still the, you know, an iteration of that. It's still the standard agreement between creative agencies, production companies, and music composers and music production companies today. That was, without that, would have had all sorts of problems. There wasn't anything else. There was no other sort of standardisation at all happening in the industry. Also, at the time, I had absolutely no idea how to budget anything. I had no idea what to do, how to charge, how, you know, it's quite complex when you start really get into it. You know, when you start looking at the production, all the extras that you have to do, that you have to charge for, the license, the term, the territory, the media, and actually even back then when actually the media's, you know, much more simple than they are now, yeah, it's still quite a complex process putting it together. So PCAM provided the tools, and still does, to help learn how to budget, and also provided lots of templates. So, you know, it saved us a fortune in having to go and speak to lawyers to get all sorts of, like, templates you need for, I don't know, non-disclosure agreements or working with freelancers or singers and all that sort of stuff. It was kind of all there. But I think more than anything at that time is when I first engaged with PCAM, it was through a production company, and PCAM were supporting on key industry issues. And at that time, there was one or two issues in the industry around pretty dodgy practice from a creative agency that will remain nameless, and a brand that will remain nameless. But PCAM, you know, campaigned around these issues and solved these issues for the good of the industry, and ensured that the professional standards and the rights and the working practices of composers in media were upheld. So, you know, PCAMS for me has always played such a huge part in, you know, in the protection of what we do, but, you know, also develops and moves with the times.
That's really interesting. So we're very much talking about creating a framework where one didn't exist that allowed us to be able to actually do this professionally.
Yes.
Right.
Fundamentally, yes.
And again, when I was sort of coming into this, I wasn't really even aware of the IPA, but that's a really significant landmark piece of manoeuvring to actually get to a position where you actually agree terms for our work. And I think there's a lot to learn from that for now. Obviously, the landscape has changed a lot, but could we just dig in a little bit more as to sort of what that conversation might have been like, what the conditions we were working under were like at the time that necessitated, and the impact of that collective bargaining position that we adopted in order to arrive at this really important framework that allowed us to be able to work.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I wasn't there at the time, but I think the point was that it was an industry that actually, you've kind of said it, lacked regulation. And, you know, as we know, and perhaps we're also experiencing in different areas today still, when you have unregulated work industries, you kind of have a free-for-all. It's a bit Wild West, and you tend to sort of, it tends to be a drive to the bottom. And so, you know, what was really driving SPAM, as was PCAM, was a desire and a need to make sure that each time they sat down to talk about doing a job with an advertising agency, they didn't have to reinvent the wheel, that they had a framework that they could start from that had been agreed by both sides of the equation, you know, very much like the, you know, the writers' union in the States, and, you know, actors and what have SAG-AFTRA, whatever, has been doing recently in the States. So it was an effort to regulate the terms and conditions under which they were working, which is why it was an initiative that was driven more by administrators than by creators. I'm sure creators were sitting there thinking, I hope we can manage to do this because it's going to make our lives a lot better or easier. But it was nevertheless driven by administrators. And as we've said in a previous episode, you know, it's easier as an administrator to go in and play hardball than it is as a creator to fight fear for yourself to a certain extent. And so, you know, they did a very good job. And our first chair was a woman called Maggie Rodford who was very much
wow,
you know, at the center.
Didn't know that.
Did you not? No, okay. So Maggie was our first chair and she was very much, you know, in the vanguard of the thing that brought about the creation of this organization. And then, you know, subsequently we had, I can't remember every organ, was Peter Waygood our second chair? I can't remember, but again, sadly he's passed, but you know, was an administrator and very knowledgeable. So yeah, as I say, it's a funny organisation because we're very light, as you know. We don't even have an office. We have a couple paid administrators to help us out, and until recently only one. But we punch well over our weight because of the terms and conditions and contracts that were negotiated really at the outset. And obviously we, you know, those have been revised and looked at, and we'll probably come on to how they probably need to be looked at and revised going forward in the light of what's going on today.
My own experience was that, again, when seeking to make my career, it was about trying to figure out a way to make it all make sense and actually engaging in conversations about budgets. It was very much, like you said, Paul, where do I go to figure out how to actually put some meat behind these numbers? Because I know that there's, you know, I know that there's money there to be had, but how do I package this in a way that makes sense? And for me, reaching out to PCAM was very much about getting my business sorted. It was almost like a ready-made back-office function with all the templates and tools and stuff that you can just run with. And again, it's about educating myself about the mechanics of the industry and actually seeing myself as running a business. And I just found it just an infinite resource, not just the templates and tools, but really critically the people and their experiences informing my decision making. And I think that's something that Yeah, you get to a certain point when you realise you don't know it all, and actually other people's experience can be really, really valuable.
Yeah.
And being able to bounce off people can really put things in a different light.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, there's a lot of creative communities out there. There's a lot of support for creative ideation, you know, songwriting, all that sort of stuff. But Baker's the only body here, you know, talking about the professionalisation of the business of writing music for media and advertising.
And
the approach is to, you know, help the business of that easier. You know, we clearly recognise that that's not necessarily an easily learned skill or something you can just, you know, come across quite easily through experience, because the experience of doing that is often pretty rocky if you don't know the background. But just being able to get hold of those resources through the PCAM website. It used to be a paper folder.
Yes, it did.
And you'd, you know, every now and again we'd get updates in the post, and you'd take out one bit of paper and put in another. Obviously, it's a lot easier now on the website.
I had a ring binder for years, PCAM ring binder.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, in there, there's kind of everything you need to know around best practice, around music rights, all the agreements and all the documents you kind of need is there, and then all the usage information, just how to tackle that. There's even, like, you know, really basic stuff in there. So no matter where you are coming from in the industry, whether you're an absolute seasoned pro or whether this is the first time you've ever engaged with music and advertising, you'll be able to find your way in and find the information that you need.
You're going to jump in this, Chris?
No, well, I was going to say, and I'm sure it's, you know, so we'll come on to, I think that talking about community, it's important to recognise that when the organisation was created, as I said before, you know, there were relatively few companies, but they all work within a square mile of each other.
Mm.
So the community was geographically very, very close. And, you know, the first time I went to and it wasn't committee meetings, they had general meetings. They had committee meetings, I'm sure, as well, but general meeting. And it was, they held it in an upstairs room at L'Escargot, the restaurant in Soho, which tells you that times were quite good, you know, as you know. And there was a big buffet at the back, on the back table, L'Escargot. And the first time I went to a meeting, there's like 40 people in the room, which pretty much represented the entire industry.
Mm.
I didn't really appreciate that at the time because it was the first time I'd been, but it really did. And I think that made it easier. They all knew each other. You know, it was very tight, and it really was a physical community.
Mm.
Whereas now, obviously, it's an entirely different landscape. And whilst it still is a community, it's much more of an online virtual community of necessity, because there's thousands of people now doing it or trying to do it. That's problematic in itself, partly because people are more inclined to feel isolated and that they're confronting these issues for themselves and they're the only one that's ever, you know, been here before. But also partly for us and for the industry, because people are isolated and having to fend for themselves or feel that they're having to fend for themselves, there is an erosion of standards,
mm-hmm.
as we've touched upon in an earlier episode, that people feel pressured to take the terms that they're being offered or take the budgets that they're being offered, which don't necessarily always stack up, and that's not always very good. And the problem is, the more people who feel pressured or, you know, required to acquiesce to those kind of terms and conditions and budgets, the more we have an erosion of the sort of standardisation that PCAM was created to try and create.
So it's almost that fragmentation, divide and conquer almost, and everyone's in their own little corner reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, and we do need, you know, it's an issue that we try to confront and have confronted, and, you know, the very process of doing these podcasts is an attempt to kind of tie it together a bit, you know.
Yeah, because you know, you talked about the change in the communities.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened when there was, you know, just a few of those few music companies, well, of now there's God knows how many. we've got quite a lot of members.
Mm.
And those members are obviously companies and individuals. Now, it used to be, of those few production companies, the composers tended to be staff members of that company, in-house writers, who would work there. That meant the production company would look after the composers, basically. They'd take the headwind of the client. And the production companies were very professional, working with PCAM. They knew how they should conduct themselves. They knew about, you know, all contracts, licenses, rights. So the composer didn't really have to worry about that at all. They just got on with being super creative.
Yeah.
Now, that's completely changed.
Yep.
That layer's gone.
Exactly. So there are many, you know, music companies still out there, you know, and some very good ones, very professional ones. But very, very few have staff writers now. The landscape's changed purely because you can reach our talent community online. You can work and transact online. It's much easier. So it kind of makes economic sense to do things and creative sense to do things that way.
And it puts the pressure, you know, very much because of this changed landscape, and again we've touched on it, that more and more individuals are having to wear lots of different hats. And those individuals are creative individuals who are temperamentally quite often not very inclined to engage with some of the hats that they need to now wear, or to play, you know, play the sort of hardball games. And you know, a creative temperament is not a business temperament, and relatively few people who are creative have a solid business head in a very sort of hard-nosed way. That's a gross generalisation, but quite often you'll find that creative people don't really want to engage in the business side of things because they don't feel so comfortable with it. And yet more and more people are having to do so. I occasionally use the analogy of a Formula One team. You know, it used to be all you had to do was get in the car and drive it. But in our industry, you also have to be able to rebuild the engine, you know, test the aerodynamics, you know, and every other job, you know, change the tyres, et cetera, et cetera, and negotiate the sponsorship deals, you know. And so the job of being a composer in media music is far more multifaceted and complex and difficult than it was when you had people representing you and your job was just to sit in a room and write music.
That brings to mind the question of supply and demand, really, because obviously there's a big component of that that leads to the kind of situation that we're in now. There are lots of people doing it. The barrier to entry has been lowered through access to technology.
Yes.
And so more people can do it, which on one side is a great thing. You've got voices that are able to come through that would not have been able to previously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it, of course, is that there are loads of people doing it.
I've seen a huge change over the last 20 years. Absolutely huge change. I mean, I think when I joined, it was the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. You know, we were moving from tape to CD. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Things already became quicker. But no, I mean, there's many more people who've been able to enter the industry. There's many more university courses, degrees, all sorts of things around media, music, and advertising. You know, and I can be quite critical, openly critical of a lot of those courses. They don't teach you the business side. They don't teach you how to be a professional. They teach you how to be a fantastic creative and produce some absolutely fantastic music and sound for advertising. But a lot of these students come out into the industry and like, you know, they're ouch, you know, suddenly confronted with all these contracts and terms and budgets and all this sort of stuff. So there's a lot more people entering the industry, which is actually, it is great. There's so much more talent out there, which is really wonderful. But there has, you know, without PCAM, there's no one looking out for them.
Well, I think, you know, what's happened to PCAM is it mirrors what happened under Margaret Thatcher, actually, which was the deregulation of broadcast. And so when you think about it, you know, if PCAM was there trying to create structure and regulation, what happened in the broadcast industry was the opposite, was deregulation. So suddenly, instead of having three or four channels, you had hundreds of channels on TV. Absolutely. And obviously that's increased now because you've got more and more online platforms, which didn't exist obviously at that time, and a proliferation of those. And so there's a lot of demand, or in a sense, you know, PCAM offers an island of regulation in a world of increased deregulation, which is a challenge for us as an organisation, because undoubtedly it's the medium landscape is looks much more like the Wild West than it did 25 years ago. You know, there's so many things out there now that weren't there then. People, so many more people out there trying to do it that weren't there then. So many, and you know, it happened in broadcast as well. Suddenly, with this proliferation of TV stations and TV channels, led to the formation of hundreds of TV production companies with people who really didn't know squat. They knew nothing about how to make a TV programme. They just created a company because, wow, there's all this opportunity now and we can make TV programmes. They'd never made a TV programme in their life, half of them. And so we're kind of reinventing the wheel for themselves in that new kind of deregulated world. And so I think that we find ourselves increasingly within PCAM not playing catch-up exactly, but trying to gather back together the strands of an increasingly disparate industry and put it into some sort of shape that works for everybody.
Yeah, because it has massively blown up again, as you mentioned, the proliferation of broadcast channels. But then you've also got proliferation of different mediums. So the games industry... Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at how the games industry has changed over that sort of similar time. Yeah. I mean, when I came into gaming, it was on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
know, Game Boy, Super Nintendo. That's like 16-bit, 8-bit, 16-bit. Mm-hmm. But the size of the industry has just grown colossally in that time.
Yeah.
And again, the volume of gaming. And then obviously you've got then the internet, the advent of the internet, and then gaming online. So not only have you got increasing number of people entering the industry, but there's also massively different forms of media that all need something that sounds good to have music in it. And sometimes the people who have been involved in setting up those structures don't have a reason to understand the value of music.
There's a hell of a lot more work out there, more so than there ever has been before. It's just absolutely tons of it. Finding that work where there's good value is the challenge. But you're right, Banky. I mean, games now become metaverses. Within metaverses, there's advertising.
That's the kicker. It's like,
wow, you know, it's kind of all falling in on itself. But there's, you know, demand goes up and down, right, generally in advertising. You know, we're experiencing a slowdown at the moment at the recording of this podcast. But, you know, I'm sure in a year or two, you know, demand's going to be soaring again. But there are so many, as you say, Banky, there's so many more different ways of composing and working in media now. Finding that right space is really difficult. But if you look at a single campaign, if we go back to a single campaign, keep it really simple, something that just was broadcast on television, it was maybe 30 seconds long, maximum of maybe two or three deliverables, maybe a couple of cutdowns, that's your lot. Often campaigns now have more than 100 plus deliverables. And that's, you know, that's pretty astonishing.
And that can just be for one territory. And then you get into international localization, which I've had the pleasure of doing some of. And again, just the volume just exponentially increases.
There's companies like A Million Ads, you know, producing, you know, hyper-localized variations, you know, targeted advertising, which has your music on it. And, you know, there's been varying degrees of success of looking at how, you know, composers can work with that by providing stems and then different mixes create different tracks for different audiences. So you could be sat at home watching, you know, the football on Sky TV. Your neighbour could be watching it as well. And in the ad break, you get different ads. That's kind of crazy. But what that is also doing on a single buy of media, that buy tends to be much cheaper. And it's much more targeted. So you don't get so many of those big blanket brand type ads which used to be very, very common and were actually, you know, there's a lot of exploitation happening on your music at that time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could charge a higher value. Now, it's actually much more targeted. So there's less buy, which means less buyout, which means less license. Mm. So, you know, that's where you're struggling. And, you know, a lot of composers do contact PCAM, sort of struggling with this, struggling with budgets. I know we had a budgeting, we have a budgeting module, or a budgeting podcast, sorry, in this series. But that is a big issue that we're supporting our members with.
I think also, the challenge for us as an organisation is to identify what's happening within the industry and within the landscape that we operate in, which I think, to be honest, we're quite good at. I think we can see what the landscape looks like. I think we've understood it. I think we continue to understand it. The harder thing is then to figure out how to react and to respond to that and try and bring the sort of common sense regulation and structure that we have been renowned for and been successful in achieving in earlier days and up to now to this far more diverse and deregulated industry. You know, because what's happening, obviously, as we can see, is that things like online platforms, big players, you know, the Netflixes of the world or the Googles or whatever it may be, the YouTubes, they exist, they come up, they become enormous, and they say, well, these are our rules. We've got this set of rules that we made for us. Mm. And these are they, and well, these are the Netflix rules. These are the YouTube rules, and it's like, hang on. What we really need is to have some common ground where the rules are, you know, not just for you, but they apply in a way that we can get our head around, and that work for all the participants,
collective good, and sustainability,
you know, and all the creative partners and you know, interested parties and what have you that are operating in this field. We are now at the moment of having to confront different types of deal and what have you every time we deal with a different platform.
Mm. Yep. It's kind of difficult to separate this from, again, we're talking about sort of macroeconomic factors here. Mm. It's difficult to separate this out from big economics. We're talking globalization here. We're talking about large entities that have a footprint in multiple territories, yep, who are beholden to no one set of rules in one geographic location. And so I know that, see, we exist on an island, but the industry is global. And so I know that PCAM are members of EXAR, for example, mm-hmm, European Composers and Songwriters Alliance. It'd be good to understand how we gear into that and how that body helps to support the conversation on a broader platform across multiple territories.
Yeah, I mean, well, EXA, I've been very involved with EXA since it was inaugurated, which was in Madrid, I think, in 2007, something mm-hmm like that. It's a long time. And I was there at that. And in fact, I drafted the initial mission statement for the organisation at that inaugural meeting in Madrid. So EXA is, as you say, it's a pan-European composer organisation, composer and songwriter organisation, and its existence was driven by a former chair of what was then Basker and is now the Ivors Academy, mm-hmm, a guy called David Ferguson. Yeah, and David Ferguson, bless him, no longer with us. And actually, because it came from that background, it was initially structured, and actually still is, in the way that Basker, British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors, as was now the Ivors Academy, with three strands to it. So the concert music strand, the media music strand, and the pop music strand. And obviously, the Ivors Academy came about by the amalgamation of three organisations that were dedicated to each of those things. So EXA is structured in the same way. It represents a large number of organisations from all across Europe. I mean, I can't remember the number, but it's a several hundred, I think, for something like 27 territories or mm-hmm countries in Europe, and has an office in Brussels, and really is primarily, well, its primary function is to do two things, really. One is to celebrate and promote the value of the creative work that its members do, that we do in the various strands of music that we're operating in. And the other is to be a campaigning body to try and regulate and make sure that people get a fair deal for what they're doing. So, you know, we're all doing that on a sort of microcosmic level or national level or whatever, and they're trying to do it on a European level. And have had some notable successes, although it's always an uphill struggle.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's good about Brussels is that European politicians, the one thing they love is creators. They love a creator, and they like hanging out with creators. And so they are, on one hand, very sympathetic to what we say to them. On the other hand, they are also constantly being bombarded by lobbyists, lobby groups representing big industry interests, who are really wanting a very different outcome very often from the outcome that we're hoping for.
They have much deeper pockets.
They have way deeper pockets. And whilst you know, we're sexy and nice to hang with, they have the bloodhounds and the budgets to really make them run. But we're all attempting to regulate an environment which is exploded exponentially. You know, it's like, oh, how can we then get this huge amount of fragmentation and bring it back into a shape that makes sense, and then we can apply regulation rather than all of us just casting around trying to, you know, as we've said before, reinvent the wheel every time we go into negotiations.
Have a solar system that can keep spinning.
Yeah, and
we've had the Big Bang, and now we need to sort of let this thing settle into some kind of solar system where we could all coexist.
Well, we're inevitably playing catch-up.
Yeah.
But that's part of the PCAM committee's role, is to keep in touch with these organisations, keep at the coalface, find out what's happening around the world and how does this affect our members, and can we lend our voice to other organisations around the world? Can we offer intelligent support in any way to campaign for you know, positive change or to counteract, you know, dodgy things or whatever's going on around the world? So, you know, it's only when there's something of benefit to our members, or if there's a significant challenge we need to make them aware of, that we'll flag stuff. But, you know, the committee's working sort of like pretty much round the clock in the background, looking and identifying this sort of stuff. And, you know, the committee itself of PCAM is made up of a group of people who do actually get quite a lot of experience, have a lot of experience and exposure to the worldwide business environment, and, you know, get approached with varying sort of agreements and contracts and all sorts of things. So there's, you know, there's a lot of experience there that we can pass on to our members.
So let's play a scenario here. And I'm saying this because I've been in some of the committees and we've had these kinds of conversations. I'm composer A in my lonely corner, working remotely. A new sexy sounding company has emerged into the market and is looking for composers. I want to make music for a living. I'm relatively early on in my journey. This looks like a big opportunity for me. And then they present me with a piece of paperwork that smells a bit fishy. How does PCAM help me as a member in that situation?
Well, firstly, if it smells a bit fishy, it probably is a fish. So, well, first and foremost, members of the PCAM committee have access to our helpline. That's basically a hotline straight into the committee, where you can access all the minds within PCAM. So you've got a whole bunch of people with legal, financial, you know, creative production, business experience that we offer for free. We offer it for free. You pay a small membership fee, and so you can tap into all of that. You could also tap into all the resources. There's all sorts of things around there about best practice. You can just go onto the website and read the best practice areas, and you'll probably find, like, hang on a minute, this contradicts with what's said here. Or if you really are struggling with an agreement and you have no idea, is this good, is it not, is it standard, flashing it in front of one of the PCAM committee members, we'll be able to tell you within a couple of minutes if something's wrong.
Yeah, it's been said that, you know, remember that we're not alone, and I think that's a really important message that needs to be understood, because it can feel very isolated, and the way that we're working now is in a more in a manner that's more prone to that feeling of isolation. Mm-hmm. But I've sat in committees where we're actually looking at a contract and you've got maybe seven people on the call with a cumulative experience of over a century in the industry weighing in on your little problem. And actually seeing those conversations and being party to those conversations is really empowering, and actually has made me feel like I'm not on my own. Mm-hmm. And I've got access to some really brilliant minds who have seen it all and done it all. And it can lend strength to your voice when you're having those negotiations, or when you find yourself in a situation when you feel out of your depth. There's someone who's seen it before, someone who's done it before, and can sort of show you the guard ropes.
You think about, okay, how much a music lawyer, a pie hour, start at 400 quid, maybe?
Probably.
That's probably old money now, to be honest.
Yeah. So 400 quid and upwards, should we say. A student membership, so first-tier membership for PCAM, is £12.50 per 6 months. That's £12.50. And if you're entering the business, you've got an annual turnover of under 75,000. It's 75 quid.
Yeah.
£75, and you get 6 months of access, 6 months to all those minds. It's phenomenally
one template,
great value.
Literally, access to one template is your money's worth multiple times over.
Multiple times, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think our challenge now, and it's, you know, partly, as I said before, the reason we're doing these podcasts, and also we have another initiative that we're hoping to bring to life in the coming year, which is an educational thing, is that we see our role really as being a sort of a still point in a moving world a bit. And we have an obligation not just to our members, although that's our primary obligation, really, but to our industry as a whole, so even people who are not members. And by helping them, we protect our profession. Because if people are on their own in a cruel, hard world, they will be more inclined, or maybe not inclined, but feel more pressurised to accept terms and conditions which are really not acceptable. And the more frequently that those kind of terms and conditions are accepted, really the more fragile the industry becomes, and the ground on which we stand becomes. So if we can reach people like that who are working on their own, sure, we'd like them to be members of PCAM, but nevertheless, what we would like them to be even more than that is well informed about the profession that they're working in and what they should say when they receive, you know, iffy sounding contracts or silly kind of numbers for budgets. And so I think by informing and educating the less experienced people who are working in this industry, we help them, hopefully, but by helping them, we protect our profession.
Because that's the thing, it's particularly when you're on your way in, we have a very narrow focus and we tend to feel like this is just my little break and I'll do it just this once.
Yeah.
But again, it might feel like to you it's just this once, but each time that happens, if we think about this again in sort of macro terms, if clients constantly are able to get one over on us because it's your first gig and you'll accept anything, we've set a precedent.
I mean, at the risk of sounding flippant, it's like, you know, every time to paraphrase, is it Peter Pan, every time you do a free demo a fairy dies.
Save the fairies, people, save the fairies.
But you know, I mean, it's a small nail in the coffin of the profession.
I mean, it's one of the major things that PCAM stands for. Professional work should be paid for, and that payment should be fair and it should be prompt.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're in the business of identifying the changing landscape that we're operating in, exploring ways in which we can apply fair terms and conditions to that environment, and then making sure that people working in the profession are aware of what those fair terms and conditions look like so that they apply them to their own working lives.
Yeah, and this is one of those situations where every contact point matters. Yeah. And if all of these contact points are informed, then we collectively set a standard with or without the formal collective bargaining position, although that is definitely necessary at points in time. I'd like to sort of take a step back a second and look at sort of wider industrial shifts. I was having a conversation earlier with you, Chris, about how our industry, as creative industries, we generally tend to be quite early adopters of technology when it comes to the actual production of our creative work. But as an industry, we're much more reluctant to embrace technology and its potential implications for the way that we do our work and for the impact it might have on our industry. And this sort of idea sort of harks back to, I remember when the CD was dying and MP3s were coming in and we had peer-to-peer music sharing, Napster, etc. And something that I've come to understand is that the industry's response to that shifting landscape of how music was being consumed and the slow response to that meant that it wasn't the music industry that determined the value of music in the digital age. It was the likes of Apple, who set up iTunes as the distribution of music in the new world. Their money, their profit was made from selling iPods at an extortionate markup. And the stuff that we make was the stuff that they filled the iPods with, and that was marked down because it wasn't really their product. But it's the industry's reluctance to embrace that technology meant that some outsider determine the parameters through which our music was being distributed. That's my view. I'm sure there are lots of different views on that, but I think that started us off on the back foot with music in the digital age. And I think that is partly responsible for some of the conversations that we have around streaming royalties and other things like that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, streaming royalties is exactly it. This is the next big shift, because the power is in the hands of the consumer. And it's funny how it's moved around, but, you know, influences... streamers, you know, we're getting commissions all the time at Massive Music for people on TikTok. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, music that they can use, which can be licensed specifically for that use. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about the brands, and they're in control. Mm-hmm. I think that is very interesting, you know, how that power shift has happened, sort of. Kind of feels like overnight, but it's not, is it?
It's a gradual process. And so I think, for me, that relationship to technological change and a reluctance to embrace it sort of is something that's in mind now, as we're obviously in this world of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And how that is interacting with and interfering with and disrupting the industries that we are all very passionate about. And I'm mindful that in the conversation around peer-to-peer file sharing, industry just ignored it like it was going to be a fad. It would go away. And then when it was clear that wasn't happening and consumers were actually very well invested in this and infrastructure was being built around it, then it was try and sue them. Mm. And that didn't work either.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the AI thing is clearly we're going to be grappling with this. And, you know, I think the whole world is grappling with this because we still don't know where it's going to take us and what the world's going to look like when it's more fully developed. And clearly there are issues. The concern now, obviously, that's being expressed by many people is this going to be a tool which humans can use to really improve and transform the world that we live in things like healthcare and you know, medicine and blah, 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 blah thing? Or is it going to be some great sort of monster that we create that's going to take us all down? Clearly, in the slightly less life or death situation of AI and music, I mean, what's important, creative industries generally, is, and I'm not saying anything that lots of people haven't already said, but that AI does not create things. it reconfigures information that it's been fed according to the parameters that it's been given to do so with. And so, Simon, earlier on, we were talking about sound-alikes in an earlier episode of the podcast. I was talking about, you know, the day when AI can produce, you know, a perfectly identical Prince track, you know, with all the grooves and the vocal and the lyric and blah blah blah, and there it all is. And I said at the time, you know, well, that's the day when we're going to see a very, very interesting lawsuit, because, you know, if you're teaching AI algorithms that are based upon copyright material, then when you actually get to the point which he was describing, you've got the classic example of what's known as passing off. If you're trying to make people believe that they're listening to something that's actually been generated artificially based upon tuition and inputting copyright material, then you are in breach of copyright.
So what we're talking about really, this is a new usage of copyrighted works that needs a framework that allows for those copyrighted works involved in this ingesting to actually be tracked and remuneration paid to those works or licenses granted for the use of copyright works in that manner. Because at the moment, it's, again, unregulated. But this is, I suppose, part of what the fight is now, to establish some parameters.
Mm. And this is happening pretty quickly.
Yes,
right?
It is.
It's a bit of a re-revolution of the digital age in music. But I think it's PCAM's role in this is to see what's happening in the industry. This is probably all going to be horrifically out of date in about 6 months. but like any big challenge to the industry, we have a working group that sits there, assesses what is going on, contacts our members, grabs intel from the members, and then as quickly as possible advise everyone on what is best practice. How can you keep legal within this? And that will then end up being part of our guidance, which will end up on our website. It'll be the next tool, the next bit of information, the next template to arrive on the PCAM website to help everyone navigate this. And at the moment, we're right in the thick of it, aren't we, on this particular one?
I mean, yes. I mean, what we want to make sure is that we don't end up in a situation where, you know, the technological tail is wagging the creative dog.
and I think I might already have whiplash from him.
And it would be nice to think that again, you know, as this gets developed, we can help to, you know, input our point of view, whereby, you know, what comes out of AI is something that takes some of the donkey work and dullness out of some of the jobs we have to do, and that allows us to be more creative and freer and more imaginative as a result, rather than be destroyed by it. And I'd like to believe that we can, as a species, as a race, we're sensible enough to try and harness it rather than let it run out of control.
Yeah. I think there's always a tendency towards fear and a tendency towards doom and gloom in these types of scenarios. These are admittedly very big questions, but I'm always, again, I guess I'm an optimist. I think in some ways you have to be an optimist to try and have a creative career anyway. Yeah. Where significant shift occurs, something's moving from one place to another. Some things will be eroded, other things will be created. Mm. And I think it's very easy to tap into the doom and gloom, but I think that approach hasn't helped us. It didn't help us in the end of the 90s and into the noughties, when peer-to-peer file sharing came around, when the MP3 changed the way that we bought and consumed music. And I don't think that attitude is going to help us now. I think we have to be thinking about how can we make it work for us.
Well, yeah, you know, and at the end of the day, post-MP3, we're still all here. We may be, you know, moaning about different problems and other issues, but we're still here and we're still making music and we're still hopefully earning a living. So, you know, these things present themselves as big issues and, you know, probably sometimes and often are big issues, but that doesn't mean that they're insurmountable, and it doesn't mean that the sky is falling.
There's always value in music and great art, right? There always will be, because if all the value in music disappeared, there would be no music. and we always find a way. You know, I think, I honestly think in 10 years' time, the industry's going to look incredibly different. And, you know, PCAM's going to be advising its membership in a completely different way. But, you know, that's fine. We're quite open within the committee to, you know, to embrace these changes and not just kind of like ignore them. We're always trying to introduce new people into the committee, new blood, people who right at the coalface, who are working and experiencing all these different changes that are happening. And in fact, you know, talking about changes with our membership, you know, you would have thought throughout lockdown that actually, you know, our membership would have tailed off a little, and people are getting squeezed for budgets that, you know, people wouldn't be able to afford PCAM or anything. In fact, our membership numbers have shot up, and that just goes to show that we're needed, which is nice to know.
Yeah, I think the reason it shot up is that people who feel isolated reach out and want to get engaged with something that gives them a degree of certainty that they didn't have before. And I think, you know, we're also very determined and willing to remain relevant as an organisation and to keep being relevant as an organisation, which means, you know, embracing the changes that are taking place and being a voice at the table of change to make sure that where we can help to generate some form of solid regulation, we can do so. And I think that's really important.
And just one more thing, Paul, you touched on the value. Music will always have value. I'm just reminded that what happened during those years of the pandemic, everyone reached out for creative product, creative content as a means of connecting, as a means of finding meaning, as a means for solace, as a means for touching someone, feeling embraced by something. And I think that value is there, and we have to remember that in times of need, people reach for the things that we actually do.
Yeah.
I think that's an important message.
I mean, we all have a wonderful job. We get paid to work in music, and we shouldn't forget that. And I think, you know, with PCAM, helping people navigate the business side of things, take a bit, you know, some of that headache away, people can concentrate a little bit more on enjoying
the things that they want to do.
Absolute fabulous job that we all get to do.
Amazing. I think, guys, we might be at time on this one now. But if I could just, is there anything either of you would like to just add as a final cherry on top?
One of the things I would say is that, you know, when you're trying to campaign and to influence people, the more people that you speak for, the more your voice is listened to. You know, in Europe, we've got EXO, which speaks for literally thousands and tens of thousands of composers. And when you're talking to a politician, that counts for something. In the same way, PCAM, you know, as a member organisation, the more people that we can say we speak for, the more we're going to be listened to.
Yep. I second that. I think PCAM has a lot to be incredibly thankful for. Especially with relationships like we have with PRS for Music and their interest and collaboration with PCAM. They've been nothing but a huge support and continue helping us with events and initiatives, education initiatives, all sorts of things. So we're very lucky to have great relationships with PRS, PRS for Music and a number of other organisations.
Well, this has been a really great discussion. Thanks, guys, for your expertise and your time. I'd just like to say a special shout out to our friends and fellow PCAM members, Forever Audio. Right now, we're actually recording in one of their 10 voiceover and sound design studios on Tottenham Court Road. If you're in the area, pop in for a coffee next time you're here. They're a really lovely bunch, and I'm sure they'd love to see you. Go to foreveraudio.com to find out more. You've been listening to the PCAM podcast. Today's episode was There and Then to Here and Now. I've been your host, Banky Ojo. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the PCAM podcast. If you found this podcast useful or would like to work in the media music industry, you might want to consider joining PCAM. As a member, you gain access to networking, a helpline, budgeting and legal resources like contract templates, seminars on navigating industry issues, and many more benefits. And your membership dues go directly to help fund our ongoing advocacy and initiatives.
For more information, visit our website at www.pcam.co.uk and become a member today. The more our collective voice grows, the greater positive impact we can have on policies and best practice in our industry.